From the studios to RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome to the week. Oh, you don't know the shape I'm in. The chorus from the great song of the same name by the wonderful band. And it's all to do with shape this week. So what shape is that, you may well ask? Well, you're soon going to find out this week on 30 Laps. Yep, it's all about shapes, curves and coefficients, and why designers shape their cars the way they do. Aerodynamics on the road, you might say. Also, let's go south of the border down Mexico way, and let's look at the great race that was the Mexican Grand Prix of 1990. The science of beautiful shape and the flying Mexican burrito brothers, all this week on 30 Laps. So let's get started, shall we? We go to the online magazine Practical Motoring, and this was updated recently by their editorial staff in November of last year. Car makers spend a fortune on making their cars slipperier, whether it's to make them more fuel efficient or faster or both. Here's how to be an instant expert on automotive aerodynamics. According to the Macquarie Dictionary of Motoring, aerodynamics is the dynamics of atmosphere interactions with moving objects, or, more colloquially, the science of reducing wind drag. And by reducing wind drag, vehicle designers, in this instance, can make car vehicles, or even just vehicles, faster, slipperier through the air because of reduced drag, and thus more fuel efficient. This article isn't intended to be an in-depth explanation of aerodynamics and or the ultimate science behind it. Rather, it's designed to give you a better understanding of aerodynamics and how it relates to vehicle design and some of the history behind it. So let's start with that history, shall we? The first vehicle to break the 100-kilometre barrier was the Jamais Contente, Never Satisfied, and it was all electric. The year was 1899. The driver of that car was Camille Ginazzi, a Belgian who determined that a streamlined shape was more likely to be slipperier than a brick-like version. He was bang on, and we'll explain why shortly. Look at the picture. That picture was a photo of a brick. It's no use describing it because all I have really was just a photo of a brick falling. Anyway, borrowing from Ginazzi's design, the 1910 Vauxhall became the first car to exceed 160 kilometres an hour with a 3-litre engine. But it was the 1921 Rumpler Troppenwagen that was the first determined attempt to use aerodynamics in the design of a vehicle. Troppenwagen. And it worked. The company didn't have a wind tunnel like car designers do today, but recent wind tunnel testing of the Troppenwagen revealed it had a coefficient drag of 0.28. That's about the same as a Jaguar F-Type in today's money. Motoring journalists quite often reading about or reading from car company script include a number they know little about. The number is the coefficient of drag, CD, and engineers spend millions of dollars and endless amounts of time in wind tunnels to make that number as small as possible. The pioneering boffins of aerodynamics determined that a teardrop was the most streamlined shape you could get and gave it a coefficient of drag of 0.00, or zero drag. Since those days, however, tests on the teardrop have revealed they're not as quite as slippery as originally thought, and should actually be assigned a rating of 0.05 CD. While a plate stood on its end into the wind realises a rating of 1.17 CD. To make this more brain-hurting, there are other qualities to consider, like front lift, CIF, rear lift, CLR, and the moment of yaw, CMY, which means the change in shape when the shape is on an angle, like a cornering car or a car hit by a sidewind. So I guess when you hear about people talking about days of yore, it's probably got another meaning again. That was me, not the article. Anyway, typically cars fall into the 0.25 CD to the 0.35 CD range, while SUVs tend to start off in the high 30s and into 40s, although even these are becoming slipperier. The formula to determine your own car's drag at a given speed requires a lot of knowledge the average motorist isn't likely to have or to be easily able to get their hands on. But to determine roughly the drag on your car at a given speed, you'll need to use this formula, CD times frontal area times density times air multiplied by speed squared. Simple, really? You might ask, why do companies bother? Well, the idea is that, and here is a typical scientific disclaimer, all things being equal, the car with the least amount of wind resistance will thus require less fuel and power to maintain a given speed. Indeed, with the car companies wanting to produce ever more fuel-efficient cars, the science of aerodynamics is becoming more and more important. And making a car slippery is tricky, and that's down to the shape and the protuberances, like wing mirrors, door handles, and even the front grille. Hence the development of active grilles that can close and force air over the bonnet. Because cars are generally shaped like a box, they start with about 50 times as much drag as, say, something shaped like a cigar, of the equivalent size and weight and travelling at the same speed, or the Jamais-Compté. If you want the vehicle to travel through the air causing the least amount of disturbance as possible, which is why car designers, together with engineering colleagues, work on shapes and surfaces to create something visually appealing, but also so slippery, the air should flow evenly around the front of the vehicle and then come together at the rear. When you force something brick-shaped through the air becomes turbulent, causing drag. Most car companies will admit that around 10% improvement in a vehicle's aerodynamics will result in a fuel efficiency gain of around 4%. This fuel efficiency gain can be quickly overcome, though, when one fits a roof rack to their car, adds a box to it, and it can often increase fuel consumption by up to 20%, as the vehicle needs to work harder to overcome the wind resistance. At highway speeds, most vehicles use around 5 times as much power to overcome the effects of drag as they do overcoming things like rolling resistance, tyres, and weight. This means the higher your vehicle's CD number, the harder it is to have to work to push through the air and keep up with the traffic. Thus, it will use more fuel. At very low speeds, like 1 to 2 kilometres per hour, wind resistance or drag is virtually nil, and so there'll be little difference between a sports car and a boxy SUV like the Toyota Land Cruiser 200 series. But as the speed doubles, the wind resistance quadruples, meaning its effect will be greater on the less aerodynamic vehicle when travelling at the same speed. Don't fit a roof rack is the first and most important message when you're looking to increase fuel consumption, because the vehicle is having to work harder to overcome the drag. Other little things like ribs on tail lights or creases in the body will help to make the airflow around the car force dirt and water away and help it slip through the air. Other little tricks like the shape and size of the wing mirrors can help, as can adding side skirts to cars. A diffuser at the rear of the car can help to smooth air coming out from under the car to reduce turbulence. the shape of the wheel arches is also important. So, the shape of your car and what you add onto it will have a net effect on the contents of your wallet, all things being equal. Upset the slipperiness of your car and the thing will have to work harder to overcome the additional drag and thus use more fuel. So thank you to the editorial staff of practicalmotoring.com.au, the online magazine, Automotive Aerodynamics Explained, and that was updated and written in 2020. Crikey. So you'll see all those hot little cars screaming around the place with the big cocky's perches on the back and the side skirts. Of course, that's all to do with coefficients and efficiency of the air passing over the body of the vehicle. Believe that, and you'll believe anything. Nevertheless, it probably does help just a little. The very song I was talking about. Funny that. Anyway, let's go south of the border down Mexico way and have a look at Mexican magic. I remember this because in June 1990, when it was run, 26th of June 1990, my son, who is now 30, was 2 months old and he was so precious I couldn't put him to bed. I had to sit up all night and just look at him. He got a bit sick of it, and eventually, so did I. However, let's talk about the race, shall we? This is from Motorsport Magazine, and it is from the August 1990 edition by Dennis Jenkins. Mexican Magic, the start of the Mexican Grand Prix of 1990. Motor racing broke out in Mexico at the Grand Prix weekend, and now I begin to realise just why those who witnessed it firsthand were so ecstatic about the heady wheel-banging battle between Gilles Villeneuve and René Arnoux at Dijon back in 1979. The display that Nigel Mansell and Gerhard Berger put on might not have observed the full code of driving ethics, as they touched on more than one occasion, but it was as if F1 was letting its hair down, as they both resolutely refocused to accept defeat. In the end, it was Mansell who got to the line first, after an utterly inspired bit of overtaking round the outside at Peralta, with a lap to go, and he duly chased home teammate Alain Prost for Ferrari 1-2, that thoroughly upset the pre-late race predictions of a McLaren-Honda rout. For the first 60 laps, it looked as though Ayrton Senna had things dans la valise, or in the bag. But a slow puncture finally took its toll, and he was trying to nurse his MP4-5 home for third place. Berger, too, had tyre problems, pitting early for fresh Goodyears before tigering back. I'm not sure what tigering back means, but hey, it's in the article, so we'll read it. Might have been something of a professional race until lap 50, when Prost and Mansell really began to make inroads into Senna's former 17-second lead. But thereafter, it proved a real humdinger. The sport needs more like this. That's not the end of the article. Sorry, folks, that's just the preamble. At the green light, it was Patrese who stormed away first, with Berger lagging slightly and Senna driving around him. Mansell lost a little ground after a good getaway. Further back was J.J. Lehto and Bernard. That's Bernard Langer, of course. Also smartly away, and by the end of the lap, the order was Senna, having swept by Patrese, along the pit straight, the Williams driver Berger, Bootson, Piquet, Mansell, Alesi, Warwick, Mantini, Dinonelli, De Cesaris, Nannini, Prost, Modena, Alberto, Suzuki, Barilla, Alio, Larini, Gugliar, Brabham, Leto and Bernard. Nakajima, tapped into a spin by Donnelly, Foytek and Pirro. Yeah, I know, I'm no Murray Walker, but hey, you can't stop listening right now. Next time around, Gerhard moved ahead of Ricciardo, the Italian already adjusting and realising that his tyre choice wasn't right, while Priest picked off Nannini and Brabham pitted with the first manifestation of the electrical problem that would bring him in and out of the pits as his team tried various components. Nothing did the trick, so it must be something in the loom, said team manager Nigel De Stater. David retired eventually, that's Brabham of course, retired eventually on lap 12, but not before Alio had nearly rammed a stationary Brabham as David paused, apprehensive about a flickering exit light at the end of the pit. Philippe had made a quick stop for tyres on lap 12 and that dropped him to the tail of the field. Ayrton Senna, that is, meanwhile, was into one of his majestic demonstrations. By lap 20, he was 15 seconds ahead of Piquet, who was going like a train in the Benetton after disposing of Patrese on lap 3 and Bjudsen 2 laps later. In his wake, Mansell and Prost were beginning to make inroads into the gripless Williams duo's advantage. While Nannini was following Prost after passing Alesi on lap 15. The Frenchman had Donnelly on his tail, Martin having worked neatly past teammate Warwick on lap 5. However, after only 10 laps, the Ulsterman felt his tyres were past their best and spent the rest of the race nursing his Lotus. Leto, Alio and Larini, who had also stopped early for fresh rubber. Gone by this stage were Pirro, whose engine blew as he passed the pits on lap 11, Brabham, the brace of Larousse, Lolas and Nakajima, the latter trio all disappeared on their 12th laps, Bernard losing his brakes after working up to 15th, Suzuki and Nakajima clashing in the S's. My car felt really good in the opening stages, said Aguri, but then the left rear tyre was gone by lap 5. I was slowly making room for the faster cars when Nakajima ran into the back of me. Up until the 45-lap mark, Senna's lead looked unassailable. 9 points in the bag. The problems he'd had balancing the car and qualifying looked a long, long way away. But then Mansell and Prost began to make some serious progress, and the thought began to gel. Was Ayrton in trouble? Gradually that thought gained substance. By lap 48, the gap between the McLaren and the lead Ferrari was 12.2 seconds. Ayrton had stabilised it a lap later, but it went down to 11.4 seconds before it opened another second lap on 51. As Mansell encountered Goulard in the S's. Within two laps, however, it was down to 9.5 seconds. This wasn't defensive driving. Ayrton definitely had a problem. Yes, the caravan of the rest of the drivers behind him was on their way, and he was on the radio. I could feel the car getting unstable, and I guessed it was a tyre problem, Senna revealed. I called the pits. They didn't hear me first time. I called again and was advised to stay out on the track. The closer it got to the end, the more sensible it seemed to keep Ayrton out there, since third place would be better than nothing, said team boss Ron Dennis. After chasing, almost immediately after Goulard, Mansell then lost a lot of ground behind Modena, again through the S's, and suddenly Prost was climbing all over him. The Frenchman had had an awful time all through qualifying, spinning on his second run on the Friday afternoon and complaining of dire lack of grip all through Saturday. But he had set up his Ferrari very carefully for the race, running less wing than Nigel. There you go, coefficients again, I'd see. you know, all about it. And had been in a highly optimistic frame of mind before the start, despite his lowest grid position in 10 years. After initial fuel tank understeer, or full fuel tank understeer, that should read, had neutralised it, he was revelling in the handling, and they completed lap 54, in a clear three-way fight for the lead. Coming down to turn one on lap 55, the two red cars swept past Fauteuil's Onyx. Mansell was momentarily left behind as he pulled the maximum slipstream, but then Prost suddenly jinked out to the far right of Mansell, and Ferrari number one slithered into second place to the screams of the spectators. By lap 60, the riding was on Senna's wall. He and Prost passed the pits nose to tail, and going to turn one, Alain pulled out from behind and went calmly into the lead. His 41st win was only laps away. The angry Mansell, when is Mansell never not angry? Anyway, the angry Mansell made short work of Ayrton, repeating Prost's move the next lap, and by lap 62, Senna was 8 seconds away from the lead. Two laps later, Mansell half spun, but Senna's fresh tenancy of second place lasted mere corners as his right rear Goodyear exploded into ribbons of rubber, and he trundled slowly in to retire. He took the blow graciously. In part, today was my fault because I didn't have to consult Ron. I could have gone in on my own new tyres. I think we called it wrong, even though Ayrton's eventual retirement was caused by a puncture rather than a tyre wear problem, said the philosophical Ron Dennis. Indeed, one of the strips left attached to the wheel showed clear evidence of puncture damage. That should be philosophical Ron Dennis. I do beg your pardon. From his position in the pits, Ayrton then had a grandstand seat for the final gripping fight between Mansell and Berger. Gerhard Berger, had made swift progress through the ranks after his stop. The misfiring Alesi on lap 50, the gripless Boutsen, who was also dealing with soft brake pedal on lap 55, Nannini on 61, Senna's demise prodded him to third, and when Mansell had the brief spin on lap 64, he sensed a chance of second after all. As the Briton recovered, Gerhard came barging by, the two touching wheels. Mansell was having none of that and immediately fought back, and they touched a second time at two of three occasions. It was Dijon 79 all over again, and the crowd were electrified. All around the track, Nigel had the Ferrari flicking one way and then the other in the McLaren's wake, and each time Gerhard slammed the door. Then, coming out of the S's on lap 68, Mansell kept far, far to the left and just kept running around the outside as they went into the Peralta. It was just a matter of closing my eyes and keeping my foot flat on the floor, he joked afterwards, but it will forever rate as one of those classic overtaking moves. Gerhard was obliged to lift a fraction, and that was that. The McLaren crossing the line a lap later, 0.4 seconds adrift after a bout of motor racing that injected some much-needed excitement into Formula One. Prost, meanwhile, had crossed 25 seconds earlier. The car was a little uncomfortable on fuel tanks, but the load lightened, it got better and better, and by the end was much more efficient. I was asking the team to keep me informed whether I was gaining or losing ground to the leader all the way, though I'm very happy. I'd had absolutely no problems. It was a tremendous fight, and my only disappointment was that I feel I had more traffic than I deserved, said Mansell, and amen to that. He was unlucky. Alain set his car up fantastically well, he continued, and deserved to win. This is a great result for the team and a great result for the world press. I was pushing hard all through, and my spin came because I pushed a bit too hard after getting offline onto the dirt, which spoiled the tyres for a corner or two. Neither he nor Berger embraced one another quite the same way after that. Arnoux and Villeneuve did at Dijon, but Gerhard obviously enjoyed himself, even if the outcome was a reversal of his hopes. But for that difference in his tyre pressures, he might have stood up atop the rostrum for the first time since joining McLaren. Like PK, Nannini had blistered one of his front tyres and as the track began to cool, found himself unable to push as hard as the leaders. Nevertheless, he was able to reel in and pass the troubled Thierry Boutsen on lap 40 and scooped another three good points that underlined the growing maturity of the Benetton's challenge. As a side note, Nannini drove for Benetton. I beg your pardon, Thierry Boutsen drove for the Benetton team. That's no longer around. Oh, Boutsen is, but Benetton isn't. Anyway, as he did in Brazil, Piquet deprived the unfortunate Jean Alesi of the final point in the closing stages, taking his healthy Benetton past the misfiring Tyrrell on lap 68, while Donnelly clung on despite his rubber problems to take 8th. My tyres were throwing big chunks into the closing stages, and having seen what happened to Senna, I was a little preoccupied, he admitted, after one of his best Formula One showings to date. The luckless Senna classified 20 behind Gouryard. It might have been something of a sleeper for its first 45 laps, but what might be the last Mexican Grand Prix ended up an absolute gem. The most exciting of the season. Come to think of it, it was probably the best since Silverstone in 1987. Up your radio. Thank you to Van the Man for providing the soundtrack to that great story. It was quite a race, I recall. Mexican Magic was the name of the article, written by Dennis Jenkinson, comes from Motorsport magazine from the August 1990 issue. And as the checkered flag drops, that's about the end of our little circuit for today. We've done well over 30 laps in 30 minutes. I'd like to thank you for your company. The show's written and produced in the Sydney studios of Radio 2RPH. This is Richard Lyon, and I look forward to welcoming you back to 30 Laps with Dick for next week, when we'll talk about something completely different. There won't be any Mexicans or Grand Prix in next week's show. Until then, I look forward to your company. Bye for now.